In June 2014, one of the remaining European hostages, Danielle Rue Ottesen, a Danish photographer, was freed. The Danish government refused to pay a ransom, but the family reportedly scraped together 3.5 million euros. Ottesen's captors allowed him to carry letters from the other hostages, except Foley. In the final months of captivity, Foley and Ottesen had been chained together, and Ottesen memorized a message from Foley to his family. One of his first calls after being freed was to recite the letter to Diane Foley. "I remember going to the mall with Dad, a very long bike ride with Mom," the message begins. "Dreams of family and friends take me away, and happiness fills my heart." Foley downplays the abuse, saying that he has weak and strong days. He adds, "We are so grateful when anyone is freed, but of course yearn for our own freedom." He mentions each of his three brothers and his sister Katie, expressing hope that he will attend her wedding one day. "Grammy, please take your medicine," he says. "Stay strong, because I am going to need your help to reclaim my life." Diane and a few of the other parents talked to some of the freed European hostages. The Europeans were guarded in those conversations, but they spoke frankly to Barfi and Bradley, and in interviews that they later gave to the press. They said that among their guards was a group of British Muslims whom the captives called the Beatles. The ones they called George and John were especially sadistic. The Beatles paid particular attention to Foley because he and John Cantley had tried to escape. Foley had made it out of his cell, but when Cantley couldn't break free of his chains, Foley surrendered. "I couldn't leave John on his own," he told the others. They were beaten savagely and waterboarded on one occasion. Later, Foley incurred the guards' anger because he requested extra rations and more frequent trips to the toilets for the weakest captives. He gave his mattress to another prisoner and slept on the stone floor. He never complained about abuse. They didn't like the fact he would not submit. Didier Francois, the French hostage, told me. He tried to establish some balance of forces with the guards, some breathing space. Foley organized informal lectures among the captives. Kassig told stories about hunting and fishing with his father. Francois described covering the war in Chechnya. Kendley explained how to pilot a plane. Foley lectured on American literature and his captivity in Libya. The others depended on Foley to keep their spirits buoyed. This guy, he was a man. Nicolas Hénin, another French hostage, later told L'Express. "He remained upright, dignified," he added. "When I see his mother's reaction, I recognize her son. They are made of the same metal." On August 7, 2014, President Obama authorized limited airstrikes on ISIS in order to relieve the Yazidis and block the jihadi advance on Erbil. Earlier this week, one Iraqi in the area cried to the world, "There is no one coming to help," Obama said in a televised address. Well, today, America is coming to help. 5 days later, the Foley family received an awkwardly spelled email asking, "How long will the sheep follow the blind shepherd?" It was addressed to the American government and their sheep-like citizens. And it continued. "You were given many chances to negotiate the release of your people via cash transactions as other governments have accepted. However, you proved very quickly to us that this is not what you are interested in. Now you return to bomb the Muslims of Iraq once again, this time resorting to aerial attacks and proxy armies, all the while cowardly shying away from a face-to-face confrontation. Today our swords are unsheathed towards you, government and citizens alike, and we will not stop until we quench our thirst for your blood, the first of which being the blood of the American citizen, James Foley. A week later, Diane got a call from a distraught reporter from the Associated Press. Diane could barely understand her. She was sobbing, Diane said. She asked if I had seen the internet. The reporter wouldn't elaborate. But within a short time, the theatrically staged execution of Diane Foley's son was all over the news. No one called her from the FBI or the State Department. She contacted her primary FBI agent, but he didn't respond. The Foley's parish priest, however, rushed to their house. "I'll never forget it," Father Paul Gauss told the magazine St. Anthony Messenger. "Diane came and hugged me and said, 'Father, please pray for me that I don't become bitter. I don't want to hate.'" When Nancy Curtis heard about Foley, she collapsed onto the kitchen floor. For the first time since the ordeal began, her spirit was broken. The Bradleys were at their house in the south of France when the phone rang. David was incredulous. "I had never thought that ISIS would kill Jim," he admitted. "The next morning, the implications hit me. For the first time in 18 months, our search for Jim was over. And we had failed Jim's family." Bradley called April Goebel in Chicago and told her of Foley's death. She went outside and sat under a tree. She called Diane, who kept saying that her son was now free. Meanwhile, dozens of Goebel's and Foley's friends filled Goebel's house. It got so crowded that some people slept on the roof that night. The next day, the Foleys got a call from the president. He was vacationing on Martha's Vineyard. Diane remarked that Jim had campaigned for Obama. "He expected you to come get him," she said. "Well, we tried," Obama replied. The president was sharing a secret. The U.S. military had launched a raid to rescue the hostages the previous month, on July 3rd. The FBI had finally interviewed two of the freed European journalists who provided detailed descriptions of the industrial building where they and 21 other foreigners had been imprisoned. U.S. officials determined that the building was outside Raqqa, the designated capital of the Islamic State. Evidently, the rescue team had arrived 3 days too late. There was a firefight in which two ISIS members were killed and an American soldier was shot in the leg, but it was all for naught. No prisoners remained at the facility. The video of Foley's execution begins with Obama making his announcement of airstrikes against ISIS. Then Foley is seen on his knees in a stretch of desert, wearing an orange jumpsuit that billows in the breeze. His head is shaved. He looks strong and not frightened. He reads out a statement denouncing the American bombing campaign, saying that his death certificate was signed that day. Then a masked figure in black brandishes a knife. "We're no longer a part of an insurgency," he says in a North London accent. "We are an Islamic army and a state that has been accepted by a large number of Muslims worldwide. So effectively, any aggression toward the Islamic State is an aggression toward Muslims." He grabs Foley's head and slashes his neck. The next shot is of Foley's bloody head resting on his back. Against his handcuffed wrists, his plastic sandals askew in the sand. Then the executioner is shown with another kneeling hostage, dressed in orange, with his head shaved. The executioner points the knife at the camera. "The life of this American citizen, Obama, depends on your next decision. It is Stephen Sotloff. Ghanem al-Kubaisi had sent an operative into Syria to see what it would take to free Theo Padnos. The operative talked his way into an extremist base, but the jihadis accused him of being a spy and threatened to kill him. The frantic emissary finally persuaded them that he really represented the Qatari government, which had suddenly taken an active interest in the life of this one American. The Qataris had repeatedly been told that the U.S. didn't pay ransom to terrorists, but it was unclear how else Padnos could be saved. The all-girl team wondered why it was the American government's business if Padnos's family arranged for another government to rescue him. But under U.S. law, conspiring to enrich an al-Qaeda affiliate such as al-Nusra was considered material support of terrorism. Kubaisi understood the constraints, and he is vague about what he proposed, saying only that he exercised influence on al-Nusra through other rebel groups in the area. Certainly, al-Nusra had many reasons to placate Qatar, one of the Gulf's strategic powers. On August 24th, Bradley received a text from Kubaisi. "Done," he wrote, along with a thumbs-up emoji. Ali Soufan had arranged for the handoff to take place in the Golan Heights, on the Israeli border, but the FBI and a dozen American officials were mistakenly waiting for him in Jordan. Bradley had to call and redirect them. As Padnos was being transported to the demilitarized zone, the FBI team was driving all night to get in place to receive him. The terrorists dropped Padnos off at a UN observation post. A doctor tenderly examined his brutalized body. Then Padnos crossed into Israel, where the American officials had just arrived. At a seaside hotel in Tel Aviv, he finally got to call Nancy. "Mom, I'm in this five-star hotel, and I'm drinking a beer, and there are women here." It was his first phone call in 2 years. An FBI agent instructed him to stay in his room. The moment she left, Padnos headed out to the beach. The Mediterranean was gorgeous. There was a paddleball court and a jogging trail. Padnos strolled down to a youth hostel. Two Canadian guys were sitting outside, and they looked friendly. Padnos impulsively walked up to them and said that he'd just been freed by al-Qaeda. They offered him a drink. The next morning, the FBI agent found Padnos, with his new friends, passed out on the floor of his hotel room. The word was out that there were other hostages, and although only a few journalists knew their names, such information was almost impossible to bottle up. The parents of Foley, Padnos, and Sotloff were instantly besieged by the press. Bradley asked Emily Lenzner, the communications director of Atlantic Media, to try to keep imperiling details out of the press. Lenzner had to plug one hole after another. She dissuaded a Washington Post reporter from running a story. Ed Kassig says that the reporter told him, "I'm going to publish. This is too big for you." A Miami television station interviewed some of Sotloff's friends, and one of them innocently commented on how much Sotloff's Jewish faith had meant to him. After Lenzner intervened, the reference was snipped from the story. But the wall of secrecy was breaking down. The Times reported that an American woman was among the ISIS hostages. Editors at the Atlantic, a few floors below Bradley's office at the Watergate, wondered how they were supposed to cover a major news event involving their employer. Bradley summoned the Sotloffs, the Kassigs, and the Muellers to Washington in the hope of devising a new strategy. They arrived on Sunday, August 24th, the very day of Padnos's release, It felt at once ominous and hopeful to see their circle of families abruptly diminished, one by murder and the other by freedom. Bradley wanted his involvement to remain secret, so they met in the conference room of a law firm. He introduced the families to Nasser Wedadi, an activist who was born in Mauritania and grew up in Syria. Bradley described him as a social media specialist. Wedadi proposed that the three mothers make a video beseeching Baghdadi to spare their children. The fact that the government and the families have remained silent for so long has allowed ISIS to totally control the process and to dehumanize the hostages, he contended. My idea is to reverse that trend. The mothers decided against a joint video. Instead, they would each make one individually. Sotloff had been placed next on ISIS's kill list, so Shirley Sotloff would release her video at once. Paula Kassig and Marsha Mueller would film similar appeals, but wait to release them. Wedadi was soon at odds with Barak Barfi over the tone and the content of Shirley's statement. Barfi urged her to cover her hair, but Wedadi thought it was patronizing and smacked of Orientalism. Barfi had combed through the Quran and Islamic history, trying to find useful precedents for a hostage release. Passages in the Quran discuss prisoners of war, but their meaning is ambiguous. For instance, in 624 AD, the Prophet Muhammad captured 70 prisoners during the Battle of Badr. His closest advisors debated ransoming or killing them. Two were executed. Other prisoners were released, including one who was not a Muslim, the husband of the Prophet's daughter Zainab. After she had sent a necklace to her father, he granted clemency to her husband. The necklace was symbolic, of course, Wedadi observes. But if the story were cited in a video, it could be misconstrued as if we were inviting a ransom, and that was a no-go zone. The more that Barfi argued for including theological references and historical parallels, the angrier Wedadi became. He and Barfi had differing conceptions of the video's audience. Barfi was addressing ISIS's leadership. Wedadi was aiming his message at the Muslim world in order to undermine ISIS's authority and appeal. Despite his frustration, Wedadi could appreciate Barfi's desperation. They were Stephen Sotloff's only hope. Shirley was numb. The other mothers tried to support her, but they were also struggling to maintain their composure. As the men commiserated with Art Sotloff, Ed Kassig and Carl Mueller talked about how painful it had been to keep the abductions a secret. Art remarked that once Stephen's name was out, his friends rushed to support him. Ed and Carl almost envied him. Marsha Mueller retreated into writing in her journal. She told Wedadi that she hoped to give it to Kayla one day, so she would know what had happened in her absence. This detail struck him with unexpected emotional force. The scale of the tragedy in Syria and Iraq was so vast, and this was just a piece of it. Millions of people had been displaced, and hundreds of thousands were dead, and yet the children of these parents had willingly placed their lives in jeopardy. They went on their own into one of the most dangerous places in the world, with the intention of helping the weak and downtrodden, who were being crushed by dictatorship and terrorism, Wedadi told me. They came to the rescue. That's why I see them as heroes. While Wedadi and Barfi fought about Shirley's script, Nur Azar, the former Syrian diplomat on Bradley's team, helped Paula Kassig create hers. The Kassigs wanted the captors to know that their son lamented the suffering of Syrians and wished to help them achieve freedom. Ed talked about how the Kassigs came from a long line of teachers. As a nurse, Paula planned to characterize her son as a caretaker. Azar told them that their approach was all wrong. ISIS doesn't care about freedom, she said. The militants think it's a Western notion that has been imposed on the Muslim world. They wouldn't be moved by the family's humanitarian legacy. ISIS was filled with foreign fighters who opposed many Syrian insurgent groups. The whole idea of nationality was anathema to them. Azar persuaded the Kasichs to highlight Peter's spirituality. Meanwhile, Shirley was struggling. I was still in a movie that had gone bad, she said. She read one script after another into the camera, but her emotional affect was wooden. She had trouble pronouncing some names and stumbled over Quranic references. She invoked Baghdadi's authority as the caliph to grant Stephen amnesty and to follow the example set by the Rashidun caliphs, who I have learned were the most just Muslim rulers under whom people of the book like Steve were protected. Wadadi bridled at this language. Putting a Jewish woman on TV lecturing to Muslims about Islam is a disaster, he contended. The video struck him as academic and labored, and Shirley appeared hypnotized. Bradley agreed that it should be reshot the next day. That night, Bradley invited the families and his team to his house for dinner once again. The Kasichs were exhausted and declined. On Embassy Row, the mood had decidedly darkened from the evening in May when the dogwoods were in bloom. Sensing this, Bradley opened the floor to any idea, however crazy. Azar proposed urging the Syrian regime to do a prisoner swap with ISIS. Bradley worried that Assad would demand something in return, something that Bradley couldn't deliver, such as spare parts for airplanes. Nor did he believe that the American government would grant such a concession. Bradley was always hard to read, even by his staff. Arete Weiler, Bradley's general counsel, thought that the video idea was a Hail Mary pass, but her boss seemed determined to keep pessimism from capsizing the process. We can't just sit around and do nothing, he said. Throughout dinner, he sketched possible action plans on a legal pad. Wadadi would go to Egypt to enlist the aid of some radical sheikhs. Bradley would go to Kurdistan and meet with its head of intelligence. He would plead with the King of Jordan for help. He would return to Qatar. He even aired the notion of hiring a private army to attempt a rescue. Shirley injected a note of hope. She kept saying, I know Steve's alive. He's going to survive. I just know it. She said that he got his strength from her parents, who had survived Auschwitz. The next morning, the Muellers were close to panic. Without revealing Kayla's name, Brian Ross of ABC had reported the details of her capture. Other journalists who had kept quiet about Kayla were angry with Emily Lenzner because they believed falsely that she had cooperated with Ross. She begged the reporters to restrain themselves. The lives of three Americans were still on the line. Bradley's team was cracking under the tension. As Wadadi and Barfi shouted at each other over Shirley's script, Weiler took Wadadi's laptop, sat on the floor beside Shirley, and quietly coached her to deliver the speech. I am sending this message to you, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi al-Qirashi al-Husseini, the caliph of the Islamic State, Shirley says in the final version. Her hair is uncovered. Her fatigue is evident. But she delivers the message potently. My son Stephen is in your hands. Stephen is a journalist who traveled to the Middle East to cover the suffering of Muslims at the hand of tyrants. Stephen is a loyal and generous son, brother, and grandson. He is an honorable man and has always tried to help the weak. We have not seen Stephen for over a year, and we miss him very much. We want to see him home safe and sound and to hug him. Since Stephen's capture, I have learned a lot about Islam. I've learned that Islam teaches that no individual should be held responsible for the sins of others. Stephen has no control over the actions of the U.S. government. He is an innocent journalist. I have also learned that you, the Caliph, can grant amnesty. I ask you to please release my child. I want what every mother wants, to live to see her children's children. I plead with you to grant me this. Shirley's video was released on August 27th and was instantly picked up by news organizations, especially Arabic satellite stations. As expected, ISIS followers on social media derided her plea, calling her Sheikha Shirley. But many other Muslims reacted with sympathy. Still, the overwhelming reaction that Wadadi had hoped for did not happen. ISIS's grisly video had made a far bigger impact. The shot of Foley kneeling in the sand before his execution was indelible. The intent of the killing was to prod the U.S. into open war with the Islamic State, a challenge that many Americans now welcomed. In 2013, Americans heavily opposed airstrikes in Syria. Now a majority favored them. An immediate, measurable consequence of the killing. For the families of the remaining hostages, there was another omen of their waning hopes. After Foley's execution, a Reuters poll found that 62% of Americans opposed paying ransoms for hostages. 6 days after Shirley's video appeared, Art Sotloff was heading out to drop off dry cleaning when a news bulletin flashed on his phone. Second American hostage killed. No one had called him. He returned home to tell Shirley. At the same time, Weiler went into Bradley's office and told him. She found him staring, ashen-faced, at his computer. He and Catherine flew to Miami to sit Shiva with the Sotloffs. Everyone has two lives, Steve had observed in a smuggled message. The second one begins when you realize you only have one. After this devastating blow, Bradley decided that his team needed a lift. Each of the meals in the Bradley's pale yellow room had marked another milestone in the hostage saga. So Bradley invited Theo Padnos to dinner. The team members finally got to meet one of the people they had worked so hard to rescue. Padnos talked about beatings, solitary confinement, exposure to cold. His captors had even buried him alive for half an hour. One nearly fatal assault left him disoriented for days. When he returned home, he ate and slept little, and wanted to be mainly in the company of women and children. His family worried about him. His thoughts could get scattered, his emotions swinging from elation to fits of weeping. At the dinner, Bradley asked Padnos what he had learned about evil. Bradley had been dwelling on this question. He remarked that the jihadis in Syria embodied the purest strain of evil and malice and violence I have ever seen in my life. No, David, it's not like that, Padnos said. Many of the young people guarding him had acted on principle when they rejected the West. But in doing so, they had been drawn into a wildly adolescent jihadi culture. Padnos had watched children playing with grenades. If someone was making tea, a kid might place a bullet on the burner, causing it to explode. For 20 of the 22 months he was held, Padnos saw women only 3 times, and always for just a few seconds. The fighters were as isolated from women as he was. Even the married men seemed uninterested in being with their wives. and yet they all wanted to marry American women, dropping hints that Padnos might hook them up. When his captors tortured him, they called it an investigation. They prayed before each session. Padnos, a student of jihadi religion, came to believe that his tormentors saw their job as a religious duty. They were trying to align people with the Quran and the sayings of the Prophet. Torturing people may be morally distasteful, but stepping outside the bounds of conventional behavior was essential in order to comply with the literal demands of the religion. The Quran and the Hadith are filled with admonitions about war and punishment. Fighting is prescribed for you, and ye dislike it. But it is possible that ye dislike a thing which is good for you, and that ye love a thing which is bad for you. But Allah knoweth, and ye know not, says one famous verse. Another says, I will cast terror into the hearts of those who disbelieve. Therefore, strike off their heads, and strike off every fingertip of them. The captors forced children to learn how to brutalize helpless prisoners, including Padnos. But in the jihadi mindset, this was a sacred task. I think the purpose of the torture is to reconcile Muslims with the literal meaning of the Quran and the ancient, they would say, eternal values of Islam, Padnos observed. Toward the end of his confinement, Padnos was taken to a villa. On a television, Al Jazeera was airing an image of a man in an orange jumpsuit in the desert. Text on the screen identified him as an American hostage. It was James Foley. Until then, Padnos hadn't known that other Americans were being held. His captors handed him the remote. But when he changed the channel, there was Foley again. After Sotloff was murdered, the black-clad killer, now universally known as Jihadi John, presented the next victim. David Haynes, a British citizen, had spent 16 years as an aid worker. He had been working for a humanitarian group in a Syrian refugee camp when he was kidnapped with an Italian colleague in March 2013. Until the European hostages were ransomed that spring, Bradley's team was unaware that there were British hostages other than John Cantley. Like the United States, the United Kingdom forbids ransom payments, and the Foreign Office had barred the families from discussing the abductions. Haynes was beheaded, and an execution video was released on September 13, 2014. Another British man, a cab driver named Alan Henning, who had spent his savings on buying a used ambulance to help Syrian refugees, was placed next in line. Peter Kassig was still not named. Until David Haynes was killed, the executions had been ordered by nationality. Bradley took hope from this violation of protocol. Perhaps there was still time to bargain for Kassig's life. A few days later, the Kassigs and the Muellers returned to Washington to meet Obama. The president had just announced that the bombing campaign against ISIS was expanding into parts of Syria. He knew that the families were angry. Art Sotloff had refused to accept a condolence call from him. At the White House, Obama expressed his sympathy to the two remaining hostage families. But they felt he didn't offer any indication that the government could help. He said if one of his daughters were taken, he would do everything he could to get her home, Carl Mueller recalled. Marcia took that to mean that we should go out and get the money. I didn't think that at all. The government continued to block our efforts. In September 2014, ISIS made a surprising adjustment in its propaganda campaign, releasing the first of a series of videos in which John Cantley offers news commentary on behalf of the Islamic State. In the first video, Cantley wears the orange jumpsuit that signals his likely execution. I want to take this opportunity to convey some facts that you can verify, he says, striking a tone of reasonableness. He sits at a wooden desk against a black background, as on Charlie Rose. He notes that he was captured 2 years earlier. Many things have changed, including the expansion of the Islamic State, to include large areas of eastern Syria and western Iraq, he observes. He says that in subsequent videos, he will explain the motivations of the Islamic State and how Western media outlets, the very organizations I used to work for, distort the truth. It was macabre to watch a man under threat of death attesting to the legitimacy of his captor's goals. The video itself was a form of psychological torture. The apparent goal of the Cantley videos was to divide Western opinion and perhaps to appeal to Muslims offended by the slaughter of hostages. Indeed, Cantley soon developed a fan base on social media. On October 3rd, Henning's death was confirmed, and this time Kassig was named as the next to die. Ed and Paula had seen reporters camped out on the Sotloff's lawn for the death watch. They established two safe houses and filled their car with enough food and water to last a week in order to escape the press horde. But an odd thing happened. Journalist friends of Peter's from the Turkish border began arriving in Indianapolis to help. They spent the entire day at our dining room table, shooting emails, every one of them doing everything they could to bring Peter home, Ed recalls. Jody Paris, a former AP reporter who taught Sunday school with Paula, volunteered to be the Kessig spokesperson. We were watching social media, Paris recalls. The theme ISIS was trying to push was, here's an army ranger who fought in Iraq and deserves to die. And we were pushing the counter-narrative of a humanitarian who was helping the Syrian people and who, in fact, had converted to Islam. Peter Kassig had been interested in Islam long before his capture. He had read the Quran while working in Palestinian camps in Lebanon. On a trip into Syria to supply Deir el-Zor, he spent hours discussing religion with a sheikh. And when he returned, he told friends that he had stopped drinking. He fasted during Ramadan. After his capture, a Syrian cellmate taught him how to pray, and he adopted the name Abdul Rahman, which means servant of the merciful God. Indianapolis has a large Muslim population, including Syrian exiles. The Islamic Society of North America has its headquarters nearby. A friend called Ed and Paula and asked if they would meet some local Syrians who had gathered at an interfaith center. Ed and Paula said yes. As Paula was looking at the building directory for the room number, Ed heard the sound of weeping. It's this way, he said. The Muslims were moved by Peter's commitment to Syria, and they and the Islamic organizations joined the campaign to pressure ISIS to spare Peter's life, holding prayer vigils in universities and mosques. Paula and Ed made their own video. I'm a school teacher and my wife is a nurse who works with refugees, Ed said into the camera, with Paula sitting beside him, her hair covered. Our son is Abdul Rahman, formerly known as Peter. Muslims who had worked with Peter in Syria added testimonials. More surprisingly, an Al-Qaeda commander tweeted that Peter had saved his life at a Syrian field hospital, performing a successful surgical operation while under bombardment from the Assad regime. The commander called Peter a humanitarian activist. Jody Paris kept up a stream of videos, tweets, and testimonials from Kassig's friends and Muslim supporters. She felt that she was personally waging the war on terror through her MacBook Air. 2 days after Peter's name was revealed, the Kassigs released a letter that he'd written, given to them by one of the freed European hostages. I figured it was time to say a few things that need saying before I have to go, Peter writes. He says that he is underweight, but not starved. I'm a tough kid, and still young, so that helps. He had cried a lot in his first few months, but a little less now. They tell us you have abandoned us, and or don't care. But of course, we know you are doing everything you can and more. Don't worry, Dad. If I do go down, I won't go thinking anything but what I know to be true. That you and Mom love me more than the moon and the stars. I am obviously pretty scared to die, but the hardest part is not knowing, wondering, hoping, and wondering if I should even hope at all. If I do die, I figure that at least you and I can seek refuge and comfort in knowing that I went out as a result of trying to alleviate suffering and helping those in need. He added that he prayed every day, although he was in a dogmatically complicated situation here. The Europeans who were incarcerated with Kassig attest to his genuine faith. But ISIS follows an apocalyptic creed that challenges the beliefs of even Orthodox Muslims. Stanley Cohen, a New York attorney who has defended members of terrorist groups, including some in Hamas and Hezbollah, read Kassig's letter in the press. According to The Guardian, Cohen enlisted several radical Islamists to try to persuade ISIS to free Kassig, by arguing that doing so could prompt the release of Muslim prisoners in Guantanamo. Cohen enlisted a Palestinian imam living in Jordan, Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, who is revered among jihadis in his effort. But before Maqdisi could act, the Jordanian government arrested him for promoting terrorist organizations. The executions had been taking place every 2 weeks. But for 6 weeks, there was a pause. Finally, on November 16th, a new ISIS video appeared. Its theatrics are markedly different from those of previous execution videos. The ceremony begins with the simultaneous beheading of about 20 hostages, many of them Syrian Air Force pilots. Then, in a separate scene, Jihadi John appears with Peter Kassig's head at his feet. There is no body. Here we are, burying the first American crusader in Dabiq, eagerly waiting for the remainder of your armies to arrive, Jihadi John says. Dabiq, a town in northern Syria, is where ISIS followers believe an apocalyptic battle between Muslims and Christians will take place. After the video aired, there was speculation that Kassig had died in a bombing, or had been shot. He appears to have a wound above one eye. He apparently did not make a statement denouncing American policy. Former Army Rangers wondered if Kassig was honoring their creed, which concludes, "Under no circumstances will I ever embarrass my country." Another significant detail of this video is that neither John Cantley nor Kayla Mueller is named as the next victim. The first memorial service for Peter was held at the Al-Huda Mosque outside Indianapolis. An imam from Damascus led the prayers. There were people from almost every continent, Ed recalled. Among them were many of Peter's friends, who then showed up at the Kassig's home that night. We had people sleeping in our camper. We had people draped across couches on the floor, Ed said. At about 3 a.m, they made a circle, and everybody went around and told Peter's story. And I really got to know my son, the man, that night. As expected, President Obama called with condolences. He was on Air Force One, returning from Asia, and his voice sounded tired. Ed told him, "You've got one last chance to make this right. Save Kayla." The two Syrians who were working on David Bradley's team had to bear the additional emotional weight of watching their homeland being destroyed. They had felt helpless about the Syrian conflict until Bradley had infused them with his entrepreneurial spirit and sense of possibility. "At last I could do something," Nasser Wadadi said. Bradley sent him to Istanbul, where he recruited a tribal sheikh who had influence in Syria. Bradley himself then flew to Istanbul to meet the sheikh. That's where he was when he got the news of Kasig's murder. Nur Azar, the former Syrian diplomat, was born in Raqqa and still has relatives there. She had also been excited when she joined Bradley's team. At the same time, she was shocked by the U.S. government's inaction. "Syrians grow up knowing that their government doesn't value their lives," she says, "but their image of the United States is informed by countless movies of Americans being rescued by the police or the FBI or the army. When did it happen that the policy became more important than the actual U.S. citizen?" she asked. "Or was it always a myth?" Although Azar never met Jim Foley, she looked at so many photographs and videos of him that she felt she had come to know him. His brutal death hit her hard. She went to two therapists. Despite having migraines, she kept coming into the office to work on the other hostage cases, but she was afraid to look at a picture of Kayla. Azar tried to find Kayla's jailers, who were assumed to be women. Through Skype and Facebook, she narrowed her search to 5 female Europeans. She even got in touch with one of their husbands, who gave her permission to talk to his wife. When Azar relayed her findings to the FBI, the Bureau told her to stop her investigation. "Contact with ISIS is breaking the law," she was told, which was not accurate. Azar felt doubly threatened because her visa status in the United States was uncertain. Though the FBI claimed to be pursuing its own inquiry, Azar was doubtful that it could succeed. "I don't think they have a woman who has the accent of Raqqa," she told me. The Bradley team always held out more hope for Kayla than for the others. It helped that she was a woman, and her ransom demand, 5 million euros, plus prisoners, was relatively low, closer to what the European governments had reportedly paid. The Muellers tried to solicit private donations, but they were rebuffed by wealthy people who, like Bradley, feared prosecution. "They would always say they were so sorry," Marcia said. Bradley was privately considering paying the ransom himself, provided that the prisoner demand could be dropped. "If it were my child, I would pay, whether it was against the law or not," he said. "But since it was not my child, I decided it was not my place. It was a 60-40 decision." There had been a threat in July that Kayla would be killed in 30 days if the ransom wasn't paid. But August 14th, her birthday, passed with her still alive. The tone of the demands for Kayla softened. The Muellers sensed that the captors really did want to release her, and yet their demands expanded to include both the release of a female al-Qaeda prisoner held in the United States and a halt to the bombing of ISIS positions. The FBI crafted replies to each message that Carl and Marcia received. "They were writing the communications and we'd just hit send," Carl said. The agency focused on lowering the expectations of the captors and never made a proper counteroffer. Meanwhile, in Qatar, Ghanem al-Kubaisi summoned one of his operatives in Syria. He wanted a message passed to ISIS. "We hear you're going to kill Kayla. Before you do, let us know. We might be interested." Kubaisi heard back that the hostage takers did not yet intend to kill her. Didier Francois, the French journalist, sometimes heard Kayla asking her jailers for fruit or sanitary napkins. The male hostages wondered who she was. Then, when Francois and the other French journalists were released, they were given 5 minutes with Kayla. She had a beautiful inner strength, Nicolas Hénin, one of the French hostages, recalled. She was looking beautiful. She was strong. I mean, to the point that Jihadi John believed she converted to Islam. And she said, "Oh, I just want to correct you. I did not convert." And I mean, no one would dare to contradict him, but she did. Jihadi John remarked to the other prisoners, "She's stronger than you. She doesn't pretend." In October 2014, a pair of Yazidi sisters, the elder was 14, turned up at a U.S. Special Operations Command center in Iraqi Kurdistan. They had been taken as slaves by Abu Sayyaf, a senior ISIS commander, along with Kayla Mueller, but had escaped. The Yazidi girls knew Kayla well enough to describe to American interrogators a tattoo of an owl feather that Kayla had on her torso. They said that Kayla worried that her obvious Western appearance would draw attention, so she stayed behind so that the Yazidi girls could have a better chance of escape. She was also taking care of another hostage, who was older and may have been wounded by shrapnel. 2 months later, Navy SEALs attempted to rescue two hostages, an American photojournalist, Luke Summers, and a South African teacher, Pierre Corky, in Yemen, where Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was holding them. During the raid, the captors killed both hostages. President Obama said that he authorized the raid because the captors had threatened to kill Summers within 72 hours. The South African, however, had been ransomed and was about to be freed. Carl and Marsha Mueller had previously told the White House that they supported a raid to save Kayla. But now they stressed that they wished to be consulted before such an attempt. "We had David and his team. We had people in Qatar and London and here working on things," Carl reasoned. "We didn't want to have a plan in place and then have Kayla killed." Bradley had been working his diplomatic contacts, and one day he got a call from the chief of staff for Qatar's foreign minister, claiming good news. "Kayla has converted and is married. She is happily living with a family and doesn't want to come home." "You don't believe that, do you?" Bradley said. He couldn't imagine that Kayla would not want to see her parents. "Is that what you'd like me to communicate to the foreign minister?" the chief of staff asked. "Exactly." Kubesi and Ali Sufan suspected that the story of Kayla's marriage was a negotiating tactic, a way out for ISIS, which could say, "We don't have her. Go talk to her husband." It might also provide the U.S. government or private individuals with a way to dodge the ransom problem. On the other hand, there was another rumor that Kayla was no longer a hostage. She was with the Kurds, fighting against ISIS. None of these stories rang true. Suddenly, an opportunity arose. In December 2014, news broke that Lebanese authorities had arrested Baghdadi's alleged former wife and one of his children, who were trying to slip into Syria using false identification. There was a discussion of a prisoner exchange involving captured Lebanese soldiers for Baghdadi's relatives. Sufan flew to Doha, where he and Kubesi discussed the possibility of adding Kayla's name to the list of prisoners to be swapped. An excited Sufan called Bradley and said that the Muellers should come to Qatar right away. Carl and Marsha packed their best clothes, asked their son to pick up their dog, and rushed to the Phoenix airport. They arrived in Qatar nearly 20 hours later, shortly before midnight. Several government officials were waiting for them, along with Sufan, whom they hadn't met before. They all got into Mercedes sedans and drove into Doha. The whole city seemed to be under construction. Carl felt that he was transported into the 22nd century. Sufan had not explained what prompted his summons, and now the opportunity to do so had already passed. That very day, the Qatari foreign minister had cancelled talks about the prisoner exchange after one of the Lebanese soldiers was killed by jihadis. But Sufan felt that Carl and Marsha could still take advantage of being in Qatar. He introduced them to Kubaisi, who wept as he heard Kayla's story and learned of her humanitarian deeds. Privately, he hoped that one day he would escort Kayla home. The Muellers were staying in a 5-star hotel, jammed with business people attending an economic convention. The next morning, when Carl went downstairs for breakfast, he was seized with paranoia. Everywhere he turned were Arabs in traditional dress. "I was beside myself," he said. "Who were these people? Were they going to kidnap me?" We went back to the room and tried to take a nap. That morning, the Muellers met with Kubaisi's deputy director, Abdullah al-Asiri. The Qataris seemed puzzled by America's reluctance to pay ransoms. "I don't know anything about this," Carl said. "I'm an auto body man." That struck a chord with Asiri, who took Carl to his cousin's house to show off an impressive car collection. They talked about drag racing, a passion of Carl's. Asiri persuaded Carl and Marsha to stay a few more days to get to know the country. They were moved to another 5-star hotel. Carl noticed the Lamborghinis and the Aston Martins parked outside. "It impressed on me the kind of people we were in with," he says. When they entered their immense suite, the television displayed a message. "Welcome, General Al-Kubaisi." Carl finally felt that the government was taking care of him. Only it wasn't his government. Wars are a beacon to idealists and adventurers and thugs, but also to a kind of tourist who is drawn to conflict for obscure personal reasons. Experienced reporters usually keep their distance from such people because their naivete not only gets them in trouble, it can get others killed. Such a tragic chain of events began in the summer of 2014 when Haruna Yukawa, a 42-year-old Japanese citizen who called himself a security consultant, crossed the Syrian border. The first person he put in jeopardy was a man he deeply admired, Kenji Goto, a Japanese journalist and pacifist. They had met in Syria in the spring of 2014 when Yukawa passed through a camp of the Free Syrian Army, where Goto was reporting. That August, Yukawa was taken into captivity by ISIS. Goto apparently felt obliged to try to free his inexperienced countrymen. The two Japanese turned up again in January 2015, kneeling at the feet of Jihadi John, who demanded $200 million within 72 hours. It was the same amount that Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe had pledged in the fight against ISIS. When the deadline expired, Yukawa was beheaded. On a video, Goto read a statement saying that ISIS wanted to exchange him for an Iraqi woman, Sajida Mubarak Atrus al-Rishawi, who had participated in the 2005 hotel suicide bombings in Amman, which killed more than 50 people. Rishawi's suicide belt failed to detonate. It is one of the most notorious terrorist events in Jordan's history. The swap didn't happen. Goto was killed. There was a hostage the Jordanians were willing to exchange for Rishawi, however. Moaz al-Kasabi, a pilot in the Jordanian Air Force whose F-16 had crashed near Raqqa on Christmas Eve. The Jordanians asked for proof of life before initiating an exchange. ISIS could not provide it. On February 3rd, the group released a video of Kasabe being burned alive inside a cage. Rishawi was hanged in revenge the next day. These deaths were a prelude to one more. When Carl Mueller got the news, he called the sheriff. The local police had already made plans, in the event of Kayla's death, to seal off the road that leads to the Mueller's house in the red granite hills outside Prescott. On February 6, 2015, ISIS tweeted that Kayla had been killed in a bombing by the Jordanian Air Force. The U.S. and Jordanian governments denied this, although the building where she was supposedly killed, a weapons storage facility, had been struck before by coalition aircraft. Carl and Marcia asked Kayla's captors to provide proof of her death. ISIS sent them several photographs of her corpse. In their note, the captors called Kayla our sister. It was 2 days after the hanging of Rishawi in Jordan, and most people on Bradley's team suspected that Kayla had actually been murdered in reprisal. Carl and Marcia agreed. Lisa Monaco, the Homeland Security advisor, suggested to me that Kayla had died in a bombing of unknown provenance. "We have no information that it was one of ours," she said, "nor was there any information to support the claims that it was a Jordanian plane. You must share the same deep sadness and sense of defeat that Kayla's execution brings to me," Bradley wrote to his team. While there was Kayla still to save, it was possible to look forward after Jim, then Steve, then Peter's death. But now, it's hard to look any direction but back at the string of defeats and unending pain created at the hands of ISIS. I don't have anything good to say here. It feels like evil won. Marcia Mueller's sisters came to Arizona for a visit, and Marcia took them into Kayla's room. In the closet, there is a trunk filled with dozens of diaries. Carl was slowly going through them when Marcia placed something on one of the closet shelves. A bag fell down. It contained Kayla's ponytail, which she had left for Marcia to give to Locks of Love. On Jim Foley's birthday, October 18th, 2 months after he was killed, a memorial service was held at his church in New Hampshire. Theo Padnos attended, and afterward, he asked Catherine Bradley, "Why did your husband save me?" She responded, "Because Jim Foley wrote him a second thank you letter." The Foleys sent the Sotloffs a magnolia sapling, which Art planted in his backyard, next to a towering palm tree that he and Stephen had grown from a coconut when Stephen was a boy. Sometimes Art sits beside the magnolia and has conversations with Stephen. "Why'd you do that?" he asks. One night, he thought that he heard Shirley listening to television. She was online, watching Stephen's execution. Art said, "They don't really show it." Shirley responded, "You see his neck, you see his foot move." Ed Kessig told me, "I have friends who say we'll get back to doing stuff the way we used to. That's gone. Now we're looking for a new normal, and where that will be, frankly, I don't know." Hundreds of Americans are kidnapped abroad every year, most of them taken by drug cartels and other criminal elements. Joshua Boyle and Caitlin Coleman, a married couple, disappeared in Afghanistan in 2012 and are presumed to be held by the Haqqani Network. Austin Tice, the photojournalist from Houston, went missing in Syria in August 2012, several months before Jim Foley was taken. He is thought to be held by the Syrian government. There may be others, but the White House refused to specify how many Americans are being held by foreign terrorist organizations. Political kidnappings pose a dilemma for U.S. presidents. Americans in captivity can, in a sense, hold the entire country hostage. Jimmy Carter's presidency was destroyed by the Iranian hostage crisis, in part because Ronald Reagan was so personally invested in the plight of American families who had relatives held in Lebanon, members of his administration authorized the secret sale of arms to Iran, leading to the Iran-Contra scandal. Since then, administrations have kept presidents from getting too close to such situations. Obama's predicament was particularly delicate. He had the choice of protecting thousands of Yazidis and Kurds at the risk of a few American lives. It was a gamble that he lost, although it might not have made any difference in the fates of Foley, Sotloff, and Kasich. After the Americans were executed, the U.S. government initiated a policy review led by the White House and coordinated by Lieutenant General Bennett Sokolic, the Director for Strategic Operational Planning at the National Counterterrorism Center. Sokolic commanded the Delta Force during the Second Iraq War. One of his jobs was rescuing hostages. "We never had one killed," he told me. His personal view is, "If I ever get taken, I want those guys to rescue me." As an army man, he added, "It's got to be the Green Berets." For the policy review, 24 American hostage families were interviewed about their experiences with the government. That led to the creation of a hostage recovery fusion cell headed by the FBI, with deputies from state and defense. These officials would report to a new division of the National Security Council, the Hostage Response Group. The goal is to fold the expertise of various agencies into a single government unit that will be represented at a high level in the White House. What we saw in our review was that our hostage policy and the mechanisms in government for engaging with the families were constructed for a different era, Lisa Monaco told me. Third-party efforts like that of Bradley's team will have a greater voice, and efforts will be made to share information more freely. "Nothing is going to be satisfactory to parents unless they get their kids back," Monaco said, "but we gotta do better." The no-ransom policy was never up for review. The U.S. government will not pay ransoms or make concessions, but it's not going to abandon families when they make private independent decisions about engaging or negotiating with hostage takers, Monaco said. "What guides us is a focus on the family's safety and security. Are they in jeopardy? Are they going to be defrauded?" I asked Ben Rhodes, the Deputy National Security Advisor, what he thought the government's responsibility was when Americans are kidnapped abroad. "We have two obligations," he said. "One is we warn our citizens beforehand about places where they may face greater risk. We also have a responsibility to any American citizen to do what we can to get them home." Whatever diplomacy the State Department engaged in, it was ineffectual, although Secretary John Kerry made numerous calls, some of them at Bradley's request. Bradley's team, along with the journalists on the Turkish border, repeatedly produced leads that the FBI failed to pursue. When Padnos came home, he was surprised to discover that his iPhone, which had been confiscated by his captors, could be remotely followed. He can still track the phone's location through various apps that his captors are using. Jim Foley had also carried an iPhone. April Goebel had given it to him. A year after his kidnapping, she asked an FBI agent if he was following the phone. Have you got the serial number? The agent asked. Even without using the Find My iPhone app, intelligence agencies can locate mobile phones and can eavesdrop on conversations while the phones are turned off. The July 2014 raid on the Raqqa facility may have been a masterpiece of coordination, as General Sakolic called it, but it came too late. The intelligence community was slow to contribute drones and other tools that might have helped the military act more quickly. The White House told the Wall Street Journal that the military's sole request for drone surveillance came just before the Raqqa raid. The government's greatest failure, however, was its handling of five American families under extraordinary duress. Bradley's team did not succeed in bringing four of those children home, but it did give the families hope and comfort. Bradley has been trying to learn from his experience. When hostages are taken, U.S. government officials often consider the families and their advocates a distraction. Yet such people frequently have resources and networks at hand, and they bring a commitment that is unequaled. Washington might benefit from positively encouraging this public-private partnership, Bradley observed. The majesty of the American government, plus all its protocols and procedures, can make for slow going. Whereas the rest of us can pick up the phone to call, say, a just-released Italian hostage, the government must labor through diplomatic channels. I don't envy them. Marcia and Carl Mueller think that the U.S. government was leading them on by asking them to send so many emails to Kayla's captors. What is so hard for us is that we had a way to get her home through negotiation, but it was used to stall in hopes of finding these people and getting them, Marcia said. After Kayla's death, representatives from the FBI and the State Department asked the Muellers to sanction a reward for information leading to the capture of Kayla's kidnappers. The reward would be between $5 million and $7 million, about the same as the ransom demand. Carl and Marcia declined. On May 16, 2015, 7 months after learning of Kayla Mueller's presence in the Abu Sayyaf household, the Delta Force conducted a raid that killed Abu Sayyaf and about a dozen fighters. The raiders also captured Abu Sayyaf's wife, Sayyaf. American intelligence learned that she was selling female captives as slaves. The Yazidi sisters, who had escaped, told American intelligence that the leader of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, would often come to the Sayyaf house where he tortured and repeatedly raped Kayla, claiming that she was his wife. He also raped one of the Yazidi girls. He forced them to watch the beheading of James Foley and said the same would happen to them if they failed to convert to Islam. Theopadnos sometimes feels burdened by the fact that he remains alive. He is still in touch with his captors, who he thinks might have been able to intercede with ISIS to free the other hostages. Often, when he was in captivity, he imagined being in a bicycle race in which he'd dropped out of the pack, forcing him to finish on his own. Which brings me to Kayla Mueller, he wrote in a blog post. She seems to have been in a mood similar to mine during her captivity. I'm sure she also spent a lot of time in private, telepathic conversations with her family. Padnos quoted from her letter. None of us could have known it would be this long, but no, I am also fighting from my side in the ways I am able, and I have a lot of fight left inside of me. I am not breaking down, and I will not give in, no matter how long it takes. I'm going to stop for a moment and talk to you directly, Kayla, Padnos wrote. If you happen to be reading this, which I think is just maybe possible, I want to tell you, I'm so sorry we let you down. I just cannot imagine how we could have done this. Sweetheart, take care of yourself. Okay?